now plugged in to the Delphi podcast.
What's up, guys? Welcome back to the Delphi podcast. I'm Tom Shaughnessy, and I help lead Delphi Ventures, as well as host some of the most in-the-weeds and thought-provoking guests across crypto, spanning Layer 1s to DeFi, NFTs, and beyond. The goal is to have fun, but also to dive deep and offer foundational episodes on projects and founders. Also, check out our research on Delphi Digital or miss out on the most compelling research there is. It's up to you. As a reminder, nothing said on this podcast is a solicitation to buy or sell any security or token or to make any financial decisions. Delphi Ventures may hold tokens mentioned, so check out our transparency page in the show notes for more info. With that, let's dive in. See you guys on the other side.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Delphi podcast. My name is Ansh Mehta. You may see me as a new face on the Delphi pod. So I work in the operations division of Delphi Ventures, and I'm also sort of an in-house expert or enthusiast of domestic politics and policy in the United States and elsewhere. And that kind of is exactly why I am hosting Mr. Matt West here, who is a candidate for Oregon's 6th Congressional District. And he's also somewhat of a DeFi degen. So we hope to kind of unpack a lot of his background, why he's running for office, how he thinks DeFi and crypto may be able to facilitate or help some of the problems that he sees in government and elsewhere. And then and kind of just rapid fire some questions. But Matt, welcome to the pod. If you can just give a quick introduction and a little bit about your background.
Sure. To start. Absolutely. Thank you so much for asking. My name is Matt West, for those of you who are not familiar with me. I have a bit of a storied background in terms of crypto. I have started mining in 2009. I did some early mining on Bitcoin for like a week. Outside of that, I got back involved in mining in 2013 with one of the very few Butterfly Labs ASICs that were actually given to real human beings. Also came with a coffee mug, for those of you who also know what I'm talking about. Outside of that, once that ASIC was no longer profitable, I became an investor, an enthusiast, activist, until 2020. At that time, I actually became a developer for Yearn during DeFi summer. Now, I've been with Strategist with Yearn ever since, but the rest of my history is a little bit different from that. I have my PhD in renewable energy research. I did research in fuel cells and batteries. Once I graduated from UT Austin with my degree, I came out to work at Intel, at their R&D facility, the research and development facility, out in the Portland metro area, where I've been my entire working adult life. And so during DeFi summer, when everyone was like dealing with the pandemic and staying home, I took on a second full-time job, essentially, as a programmer with Yearn. I taught myself programming. I hadn't done any since my first year of undergrad college, which was my teachers at Yearn were extremely patient with me. Thank you so much for that. But I had basically been working full-time, both jobs, and I brought me to here, to running for Congress. I started running for office in early summer of 2021, but that is my very storied background, lots of different twists and turns along the way, but I'm very proud to be running a race right now to represent Oregon's brand new district.
Great. Thank you for that intro. I think super helpful. I guess just one thing I've actually been curious about, and not to hit you with the curveball in the beginning, but what is it about, I guess, frontier tech that really excites you and interests you? Because you got your PhD in kind of researching fuel cell technologies, and now you're in crypto, decentralized finance, very much the bleeding edge. So kind of what interests you about these sorts of tech?
That's a great question. Thank you so much. In all honesty, I think the answer is that these sorts of bleeding tech opportunities are all based in sort of an optimism for the future. I started researching renewable energy fuel cells that was very specifically with a goal to combat climate change. That was always going to be my academic career. I went into undergrad specifically knowing that I wanted to work in renewable energy. My work at Intel was a bit of a sidestep into industrial life for a bit, working at their manufacturing facility, being on the tech floor, actually the fab floor with the heavy equipment, the machines, as well as in the office. But in terms of blockchain, what was super fascinating about it to me is it's always like that one moment where it suddenly clicks for you. I think that moment for me was not like my first week in mining it, which was just seen as like this is a cool, new, interesting concept. It was when I was trying to transfer my personal money from one bank to another bank, and having to go through that very long period of checks and transactions with them as like double checking that I did have that money and the other bank verifying that yes, you do, take like 3-4 days for it to go through. Whereas my first interaction on the blockchain was like that. Within a couple of minutes, it went through, it settled, and it was just eye-opening to me. Whether you're talking about domestic money transfer or even international, it's the same amount of time. And anyone who has done an international wire transfer or remittance also knows that there's even longer periods of wait there. So that was my aha moment for what blockchain could really do for like just the very base case use, right? Like the original idea of Bitcoin in terms of being able to transfer money quickly and easily anywhere around the world without the need for government regulations getting in the way. Now, Ethereum is where I've done most of my work, and that is a completely revolutionary idea in terms of turning a blockchain programmable. So
I think that was my aha moment, kind of understanding, oh, you can actually do stuff with this and really put a lot out there.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So, and like, I was teaching some of my close friends little courses on decentralized finance about like how to become a Uniswap liquidity provider, how you can make money based on people trading against the pairs and just other things that you could do in the space. I told them about various different investment and saving protocols so they could get interest rates far higher than they were be able to get with at their bank. But right, the DeFi summer of 2020 was a complete game changer. Now we had these protocols specifically programmed in various ways that you could kind of like move the various money Legos around and build strategies specifically where you could deploy money in one place, get a return on investment, and then pull it back. The farming heat was wild, whether you were talking about yams or you were talking about synthetic staking or so many just brand new projects coming out every day. But I was fascinated by the idea of being able to move these little Legos around, say deposit Ether to Maker, get DAI, and then put that DAI into work at some other like yam farm or something of that nature. I just fell in love. And so when Wi-Fi, Yearn Finance, came out and was trying to get different strategies for various vaults at the very beginning of the protocol, I was super interested. I started posting different ideas to their forums, and I was reached out to by another member of the community who asked me if I wanted to join him in being joining a hackathon, the ETH online hackathon in, I think it was October, August of 2020.
Could you actually speak more to that? Actually, like, specifically, what made you say, okay, I'm going to post on some of these Yearn forums and really kind of take a more active approach kind of in the protocol itself? Because I feel like that's how you fell down the stairs of becoming a strategy developer, right, so to speak?
Absolutely. I appreciate that. I was very much, like, at the very beginning, finding ways that I could deposit my money in one place, take out a loan, and put it somewhere else. And it was
just the composable nature, which was probably
exactly
really what attracted
me. The composability. And it was fascinating. And it was really sort of energetic trying to figure out how to, like, play the game a little bit in order to get the highest return on investment. But for me, as an individual user, once gas became expensive, a lot of those optimizations of where to put your money became cost prohibitive. But with Yearn and the vaults, that was a sort of collectivized nature of moving money back and forth worth like a socialized gas fee, essentially, at the very right beginning. And that was the aha moment for me, was like regular users are going to put their money in this pool and say, hey, you're the expert, figure out the best way for me to get a return on investment on it in a way that is going to, I don't need to have $100,000 to help cover the gas fees and the sort of thing. I can throw in my $100.
Right.
And it will actually earn an interest over time. For me, that was when I really got excited for all the various things that I could do. So I just started coming up with ideas. I knew various protocols around the ecosystem. I proposed a synthetic staking vault. I proposed some other stuff, but the one that got picked up on was my Hedgic proposal. That was a strategy to deposit, you know, ETH and wrapped Bitcoin into Hedgic's protocol to get staking lots. That was the one where a community member reached out to me and we teamed up for the hackathon. We won Yearn's top prize for that hackathon and we basically became strategists ever since. And that strategy became Yearn's very first V2 Vault. So it was really exciting to go from some random guy posting ideas on the forums and becoming a strategist. And that was one of the really cool things.
It's a testament to how quickly you could get involved and also just how horizontal some of these are in nature, right? If you have the idea and you have kind of the expertise, you can participate in a very meaningful way right away. And I believe when we last spoke, you mentioned that you were even on the multisig for quite a while, 4 years.
I was a member of the Yearn Strategist multisig from the multisig's inception. I took a step back when I started running for office for multiple reasons, time for one, optics and, you know, conflict of interest for the other. But I was happily a multisig member. I think there were six of us at the time.
It's funny, there's members of Congress who don't even want to not trade on possibly insider information, and you have Matt West here running for office already ameliorating any conflicts of interest. Just something I noticed there. So yeah, I guess it's fair to say that just on this brief introduction that kind of this Byzantine path you had taken from learning crypto to a strategist, that you're a bit of a degen. I think, again, when we last spoke, we mentioned your degen score that just for those listening, I think, Matt, what was it? It was 632?
I thought it was in the 700s. I can pull it up really fast because I definitely sent it to you.
Yeah, so I think when we last spoke, I had mentioned DGEN score and was curious to see, based on Matt's early DeFi experience and potentially maybe even a rug or two, what that looked like.
Ah, yes, you were correct. It was 625. Yep.
That's still certifiably quite DGEN. And I guess for those at home that may not be familiar, it's a score out of 750, kind of taking into account your DeFi accolades or issues that you may have faced. But safe to say that Matt's been involved. So I guess now shifting kind of where the worlds meet, right? Where does policy kind of intersect with this? I think it's fair to say that we're still in a phase of just discovery of what this technology is. And, you know, there's a bunch of reasons, whether they're in the media or elsewhere, that kind of point to the combative nature of some policymakers towards just decentralized technologies, specifically crypto, and just kind of decentralized finance as well, and particularly stablecoins. But I guess I want to now shift the discussion to focus on a lot of how you are thinking about these things, how you think it would be helpful to explain to people, hopefully, or that you might be working next to one day as colleagues. How do we kind of explain some of these tech kind of frontier pain points?
Absolutely. This is one of the biggest questions that we have to face as a community right now. Whether we're talking about basically any technology, there are a few people currently on the Hill who are evidently not aware of the actual underlying technology. That can be said of science as well. Whether we're talking about climate change or the pandemic, there are people who are in charge, in power right now, who do not understand the core concepts of which they're legislating on. This is one of the main reasons why I actually jumped into this race. This district is brand new in Oregon. We went from 5 to 6, so it's an open seat. But I was sitting around in summer of 2021, and I was noticing, you know, a massive heat wave in Oregon. We had, I think I got to 116 degrees, 1 degree shy of Las Vegas's all-time high temperature. My apartment, which does have one tiny little air conditioner, got to 94 degrees Fahrenheit. So it was excruciating. We also have these wildfires with crowding smoke. And then we had the ongoing pandemic and the new wave of the Delta variant, which was overloading Oregon's hospitals at the time. These were all things that a lot of people who are currently in power were not like addressing as actually either real or saying nonsense. And whether it's from the media or from elected officials, I felt like I needed to do something. I needed to step in. And so I thought it was time for someone with an actual scientific background to help pass laws and regulations that would actually solve the core problem. So a few weeks into building my team, that's when the 605OI provision came out in the infrastructure bill, which did a host of things that essentially would make crypto and Web3 and blockchain as we know it today unworkable in the United States. We're talking...
Yeah, I recall a lot of group chats talking about that in detail and maybe even like how to respond, how to even think about it, and what does it ultimately mean. I think it was a lot of confusion, quite frankly, just even among us in the industry really that are in it all the time.
Absolutely. I mean, this was something that was constantly coming up, not just on crypto Twitter, but also in my group chats at Yearn. People were trying to dissect it and figure out what the heck that it means. And Yearn is an international group of people, right? So if it becomes hostile in the United States towards Yearn, Yearn won't shut down, but it will not be good for the company. It won't be good for the United States in general to ban crypto. Certainly not good for any of the citizens who are using crypto as a way to invest or build their wealth in a way that hasn't been possible for them before in their lives. But it was just clear nonsense. The idea that you had to have every single transaction that goes through any node double checked and validated as though you're a money transmitter. Anytime you wanted to have a personal sale of an NFT, say over $10,000, which to be clear is a private sale of art from one individual to another, now you need to know that person's social security number or tax ID number. These were very obviously rules and regulations that were being passed on extremely old ways of thinking about money transmitting and remittances. So it was very clear from the beginning that this is a framework that will not work for crypto. It is based in outdated understanding and just became yet another instance of why I felt like I needed to run. I have been here in the space since the beginning. I'm a developer. I've studied how these blockchains actually work, how the composability of the contracts work. And the people who are passing laws right now don't understand the core concept of this technology. So here we are. I'm running for Congress. I feel like if we want people to actually pass laws that make sense for crypto, to help defend it and regulate it in a way that makes sense and is better for the industry as a whole, we need to get people like me inside so we can actually shape the discussion before it ever becomes public what the bill is supposed to say. We can have already tailored it to a way that makes sense.
Right. Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think, yeah, you're right. It starts first with the education, but then, you know, also, and I think this is, you know, where I want to shift to is the use cases. So this opens up a lot of use cases. Again, being that it is a frontier piece of tech, we're still kind of exploring that. I think when you have things like DeFi that start to take off, especially with the financial motive, it's easier almost to innovate rapidly and kind of have that incentive there for folks. But I'd like to kind of sit for a minute and focus on just the potential use cases. I mean, even as far-fetched as they might seem today, that might be possible as a result of this tech. And I think that's really how we advocate for it, to bring in folks with otherwise disparate interests. But yeah, if you could maybe hit on maybe one or two of the things, maybe even you're thinking about utilizing in your day-to-day, be it on the campaign or just within some of the stuff you've seen in the private sector, for what this opens up.
Sure. I mean, I think a lot of this, we're currently seeing new use cases come up on almost a weekly, monthly basis. Things that we never would have imagined before are introduced. Fractionalizing art to take loans out against it, for example, is a fairly new use case that I don't think has ever existed before. So if we were trying to pass legislation or regulation based on something that we don't even know what the technology is able to open, it's a really exciting time to be in the area. For me, what I have personally been drawn to is the DeFi space. Even if we want to go into like the sort of centralized aspects of it, say a BlockFi account, if you deposit money to a BlockFi account in crypto, you can take out a loan against it if you so choose, but also you get interest rates that are far superior to anything you can get in a traditional bank. I mean, an 8% or so, not plugging BlockFi especially here, but you know, 8 to 10% in the industry is fairly normal for a deposit on stablecoins. That is essentially a guaranteed return and is far better than what the average is for a stock market over this period of like 5 to 10 years, which averages between 5 or 7%, depending on what time scale you look at.
And forget comparing it to like an interest rate account.
I mean, yeah, we're talking 8% to 10% as opposed to 0.1%. I distinctly remember, exactly, a year. I distinctly remember when my bank sent me a congratulations, our new high interest account has bumped up to 0.15%.
Not worth the paper it's printed on.
Quite literally. I mean, we're dealing with a complete disconnect in the idea of saving your money, building your wealth, And in our current banking system as we have it today, that's not possible unless you are to invest in risk-on assets. Right now we're seeing inflation 7% or so. Compare that to 0.15% in your bank account. It's insane. You'll lose money on an annual year, and you will never be able to lift yourself up or improve your family's future dealing with that sort of a system. When we're talking about on the campaign, we are able to accept donations in cryptocurrency, which is awesome. But what we're finding the main use case here on the campaign trail is talking about what crypto can bring to people in their daily lives. There's a sense of historical story about what crypto is. Whenever people I'm talking to, generally speaking, who are outside of the space, when they hear crypto, they primarily think Bitcoin. They think of crypto anarchists. They think of get the government out of my money sort of talking points. And while that's all there and that's been here ever since the beginning, there's all these new networks and new use cases where we're able to do things like, I mean, a big talking point for people in the Democratic Party is banking the unbanked. There's a certain subsection of our population, not just here, but across the entire world, that do not have access to traditional financial systems. This changes that. 60% of the people in the United States who do not have a bank account have access to a smartphone. That is a massive population that we can just tap into immediately, get them actual banking services, and help to improve their financial lives at interest rates far better than they could at any commercial bank.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And I think the data kind of speaks to that, right? It's just the connection between how many people have smartphones and they still don't have like the basic financial pipes to be able to like live their lives. So that's the gap we're trying to mitigate. But that kind of segues right into what I wanted to talk about next is we can all sit here and talk about how much we love DeFi all day long, and we do sometimes, but we have to kind of also be very, very honest about some of the challenges, right? And I think some of those challenges or the fear of those challenges getting out of hand, such as the risk associated with hacking or what have you, that's why crypto also gets a bad rap. So in your eyes, what are some of the, I guess, be it infrastructure or security or I guess other frameworks that haven't even come out yet, but what are the, I guess, pain points that need to be addressed for just the adoption just from the legislating public and just the public writ large that might be skeptical for a few reasons?
Those are excellent questions. I think I'm going to have to subdivide it a little bit because that was so broad. In terms of getting average everyday people into using these networks, really the first hurdle they have to deal with is user experience. To be completely fair, a lot of the various like protocols in DeFi right now, some of them that I love dearly, don't have the sort of user experience integrated that is necessary to onboard somebody in 5 to 10 minutes. That's like the whole core concept of introducing somebody to a brand new Apple product or introducing somebody to a, you know, old Linux machine without any graphical user interface whatsoever. I mean, there's a huge learning curve there, and that's why the iPhone has proved to be so popular. This is the exact sort of issue that we're going to have when we're talking about DeFi. What is the application that is going to connect people to all of these different end points to help them save their money, to invest their money, to loan their money in a way that doesn't mean they have to learn code? That doesn't mean they have to learn how to self-host their own wallet on MetaMask, go to Etherscan, sign these transactions themselves, or God forbid, go into actual, you know, line editing and do some actual line programming of code themselves.
Just go right for the contract. That's what we want people to do, right?
I mean, that's what we've had to learn. Being in the forefront is going to Etherscan, reading the code ourselves, determining whether or not this is going to get rugged. Is it a scam? Is it legitimate? These are all things that we can't just expect somebody to walk on and to do within day one. Like, there needs to be some sort of onboarding process that makes that easy for a consumer perspective, because as much as I love this technology and the nerdy money Legos, as much as you do as well, there are plenty of people who just want to say, here's my money, make it work, and go away. I mean, that's why we have hedge funds right now. That's why we have money managers right now, is because people want to live their lives in a way that they don't have to worry about their finances constantly. So I think that's a huge issue when it comes to individual pain points. But I mean, you can look at numerous different wallets right now on the smartphones that are actually getting there. I know a few, say Argent, for example, is one that I've played around with personally a little bit. Even Coinbase has their own wallet, which is trying to do something very similar. So I think we are getting to that point, but I really do believe that that is going to be like the killer app, basically, that turns this from a sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? Enthusiasts all talking to each other in our own little Telegram chats into actually a mass adoption.
Yeah, I guess it's really just what brings it to scale, right? Like that's probably what we're trying to say. And I think, yeah, that makes a lot of sense, right? And just as someone who sits on the venture side of it, we see a lot of that every day. Like there's a lot of people building really great financial use cases, but we definitely see some folks putting in the real work as far as UX goes, because I think that's huge, right? That's how it's going to work.
Absolutely. And on the other side, when we're talking about how to scale institutions and how to scale from the other perspective, it comes down to regulations. Right now, there are tons and tons and tons of people and institutions who want to get involved in this space, but are afraid to dip their toes in the water because they don't know what's allowed. They don't know what they can do. So you have some groups who are a little bit more risk on when it comes to that. But you also have some like large banks who are intentionally sitting out on the sidelines, who see 8% APY on some of these protocols, and they want to be able to provide that, not just for their bottom line, but for their users as a way to get them more value and bring more users to their bank. But they're afraid, they're locked, because they don't know, will they be breaking any money transmitter laws? Will they be infringing? There's this huge gray area, which is extremely dangerous for a lot of these regulated companies, because the last thing they want to do is do something that they think is okay, and then have a regulator or the government come by later and say, no, actually, you broke this law. There was, you know, no real, like, there was no real guidance regulation there, but we, after the fact, have determined that you actually did break the law, and so now we're going to go through this whole process and punish you, even though they were acting in good faith at the moment. I mean, there are numerous instances of that, and I'm sure you can name a few. I'm sure everyone watching this can name a few. But I think that's the real risk. When we're talking about just people passing these legislations and passing these regulations that will otherwise completely hinder the industry. I mean, the United States cannot destroy these networks. They can't destroy Bitcoin. They can't destroy Ethereum. What they can do is drive a lot of the development and innovation of these networks offshore. And that's a huge risk, not necessarily for the technology and the industry, but that's a risk for us as a nation as well. By doing that, we don't have the ability to be part of the solution and guiding these networks into a way that reflects our national values of, you know, getting everyone being on a same level playing field, of everyone having access to the same tools, of people being able to protect themselves when they go on the internet and have the knowledge that they're not having their data scraped constantly by one of like the big three or four tech companies that currently do that right now.
Yeah.
That's a huge risk for us as a nation if we become outright hostile towards this, which is why we need people, once again, like me, who understand these issues, who understand the value that it can bring inside government in order to help craft that regulation and in order to make sure that these large institutions have that framework, have that level playing field where they know what they can do. And that's going to bring in tons of value to our community. Will really unlock a growth rate that we've never seen before. But I do need the help of the community in order to get into Washington and actually help pass these laws. So for those of you who are listening, please do go to my website, www.mattwestforcongress.com. And please take a look around, look at my policy, and donate, especially. It does require donating in order to get in there. It's a huge issue.
Definitely. And yeah, I mean, who's going to hit on that multiple times. You know, just have to give out your info to see how you can support. And Matt's very, he's active on Twitter, crypto Twitter, politics Twitter. Those are already two very active Twitter subsectors, but Matt, reach out to Matt on there too. That's actually how we met, like so many other folks, just intersected in crypto just through Twitter itself. But yeah, Matt, I think you kind of, again, segued me perfectly into, let's just fast forward exactly a year from now. Everything goes great this year. You are elected to Congress. Congrats. I guess, what is the general playbook for how you would kind of help to regulate and kind of get the word out there for exactly how to treat kind of decentralized assets or just decentralized blockchains and just all of these different concepts we talked about? I know a lot of the stuff has been thrown around, possible frameworks, safe harbor. Would love to just get your thoughts, hypothetically, of course, as for like what you would do kind of hitting the ground next year.
Sure. That's great. Honestly, one of the biggest things that we can do is just be an advocate for the space to other legislators and to the regulators themselves. I think when we're looking at the current framework of how these various things are regulated, how they're handled, it's very clear that since we do not have any real legislation to describe these networks, to describe these assets, that we're using old regulations to try to become analogous to current bleeding edge technology.
If I have to hear Howie test one more time, I might lose it. I might have to mute it from my Twitter soon.
I mean, exactly. It is just, it's fascinating how we're trying to shove this square peg through a round hole, but that is what the regulators have to work with. They have the laws as they stand, and so they are obligated to work within that framework. I think this is a huge opportunity for us to get legislators to pass a new framework that will allow the regulators extra room in how they interpret these issues. One is in particular, like you mentioned, is safe harbor. This is exactly what I was talking about previously when people are trying to build something brand new and they don't really know what the laws are or the regulations are, because it's kind of a gray area. A safe harbor would allow these new protocols to experiment, to develop, and they wouldn't have to go under that regulatory scrutiny to that level until the end of that safe harbor period, say 3 years. At that point, you could then go and look at what they've built and say, okay, is this centralized or is this decentralized? Is this a use token or is this asset store of value token? Is this a voting right share token? All of those things have to be looked at in order to determine, is this an asset? Is it a security? Is it a stable coin? There's so many different of those little knobs and like small granular details that cannot really be understood until one protocol is built. The current like language about how we talk about Bitcoin, for example, is very different from how we talked about it at the very beginning of a seamless cash peer-to-peer transfer. Now the language is that it's a store of wealth, a sovereign store of wealth, in order to hedge against inflation. That was always in the Genesis block, but the core idea was making it easy to transfer money. But then, say 2017, when the blockchain became really, really swollen and stagnated, suddenly people were talking about, oh, well, it's a good thing that it's hard to send this, because it's really hard to send gold physically. So that's a huge issue for why I think safe harbor is crucial.
It's almost as if the safe harbor is like outsourcing some of the research or due diligence that happens on other like large issues, where, you know, Congress will fund research if it's a medical research topic and then kind of figure out how to legislate it. And this is kind of, since it's determined by market participants in a lot of ways, it's, let's just take the regulatory cooling effect out of there and just kind of see, like, give them enough room to operate and then see kind of how to put in the guardrails, if any.
I mean, I think that's a really great way of looking at it. The issue is that we do need regulations, but we don't know what the use cases are always going to be for an emerging protocol, especially for technology that is this nascent. So trying to legislate and regulate something that's never been done before is kind of tricky. You can try to do that in research. You can try to do those sorts of things through the CBO and all of those various think tanks. But a lot of those have frameworks of existing technologies or existing protocols or, say, systems that they can use across the world. Say if they want to research how single payer healthcare would look, we have other places in the world that we can take a look at, learn from, and extrapolate on. A brand new technology that's never existed before, we're all flying in the dark together. So that's why I think until we've become a little bit more established, a safe harbor is so crucial. That gives people the ability to start building new ideas without immediately at the very beginning wondering, will this be something that is found out to be illegal once I build it? And that really hampers a lot of these, you know, developers who are brought into this space through passion and skill and just really wanting to create, and asking them to do like legal due diligence before they even start writing their first line of code. And I think
it's like, I'd rather do anything else. So they're just going to pivot to some other project.
Exactly. Exactly. So I think that is an absolutely key aspect in order to make this space continue to thrive and grow as it has been over the last decade. I mean, it's a $2+ trillion industry and community that we've grown over the last 10 years, 13 years. That is truly a bewildering amount of speed.
Yeah, it's like everyone always says, right? Zoom out. But yeah, I guess now we can let our hair down and kind of ask some more lighthearted questions. What has been exciting you lately, be it, you know, in your land? You know, there's been a lot going on with Phantom. I don't know if you're still writing any strategies. I'm sure you don't have a ton of time, but who knows, maybe you still are. Yeah, what's exciting you these days in DeFi land or elsewhere?
I mean, I think what's really exciting right now in terms of just blockchains as a whole is whenever I go to a meeting or a convention and I start talking to people, they'll ask me, have you heard about this project on this network? And in honesty, I get to say, no, I haven't. Yeah. That's awesome. Tell me more about it. I think that's like, we're now growing to a point where keeping tabs on every project is now completely impossible. That would be like at the very beginning of the internet, you would know most of the sites that were on there. But right now, if somebody asks you, hey, did you see this new website that went up 2 days ago? Of course you haven't. Exactly. So that's what I'm super excited by when we're talking about this space is there's always something new. There's always some new use case. We're constantly iterating on each other's work and learning from each other's work. And we're really in a very supportive environment in that sense for the most part. Like, people want to work together. They want to solve these problems together. And that's truly amazing. There's so few places that exist like that across the world these days. But here, we really have built something extremely special. As you mentioned, Phantom is growing at a clip that's pretty impressive, especially with Yearn, the current thing that Andre's working on, those new VE wars. That's fun to watch, see how that's evolving. I'm really excited by all of these new networks that are trying new things, all moving towards proof of stake, it seems like, for many of them. Some of them are trying new proof of whatever you want to talk about, new validation.
One thing,
methods.
It's almost like you were about to say this almost, but I don't know how I haven't asked you yet, but I guess just what are your thoughts on DAOs, generally speaking, and just they've been getting so much hype just the last few months. And of course, as people start their year of X list for 2022, DAO was mentioned, I think, on most, if not all, the main pieces that I had read. But just what are your, I guess, general first impression or thoughts on the way DAOs are going? And then if you could just speak on like maybe some of the possibilities you see just as far as like coordination, because that's really what it is, right? It's a resource coordination or an attention coordination kind of exercise. So how does that work, especially in like the framework of like NGOs and stuff that happens in the public sphere?
I mean, I think you answered your own question there by asking it. The growth of DAOs is fascinating. This is a way for people across the internet to engage with each other in a way to form their own community in a way that is awesome. We see DAOs about things like buying the U.S. Constitution.
Did you do that one? Did you do the Constitution DAO?
I was not involved in that one. I was not sure how that would look if I'm running for office and trying to buy the Constitution.
Fair point.
So I specifically stayed out of it.
Patriotic, at the least, there, right?
I can see that. I can see that. I'm sure there would have been a few attack ads about how I'm trying to buy the government. So I'm like, oh, I'll stay away from that one. Personally, the one that I was really excited by was buying the copy of Dune, the Dune DAO that just went out. I'm a particularly nerdy fan of Dune. I have a few of the original series in first editions, that level of nerdiness. So I saw that.
You probably can't see it, but it's one of the books on my nightstand back there. It's a copy of the first Dune book.
Awesome. Truly. Like, if you've not read it yet, it is a trip. It is dense, but it's wonderful. I remember I read it for the first time in middle school on vacation. And then as soon as I finished reading it, I immediately went back and started reading it a second time. It's masterpiece. But outside of that, I mean, DAOs are a perfect example of something that is emerging that we've never seen before, that are evolving in a way that we couldn't imagine, whether we're talking about social DAOs or talking about investment DAOs, or, I mean, we've seen people set up DAOs specifically to try to combat climate change. Climate DAO. Like, there's so many of these different things that are emerging, and basically what it really is at the core is a group of people working together on some task or some shared sense of whatever, even if it's just working together to create a community where they all just get to hang out and be friends. It's really like the idea of formalizing groups. So you could see DAOs in the future that are essentially regulated as corporations, if they're for a for-profit right. institution. You could see some that are NGOs, if they're not for profit and they are trying to serve some public good. It's awesome. I'm really excited to see how they continue to play out.
I feel like we're going to see a 501c3 organization, a nonprofit, for those of you who don't study this US code for no reason. 501c3 that kind of is yield farming with some of their donations. I could see that. I could see that happening soon.
I know there's some project. It probably is.
See, I can't.
Exactly.
I can't even keep up. But I'm saying even on a larger scale, I'm predicting that that's going to just be like a part of this passive yield earning vehicles. It's going to be attractive to a lot of people.
Absolutely. I mean, we're going to see businesses work together to build these new things, whether it's for NGOs or whether it's just for their own users. But once again, that requires legislation that allows them to do this in a way that they know they're not going to be infringing on any laws unintentionally. So
exactly,
I think that's the
crux of the conversation. But yeah, sure. If you had any parting thoughts, I guess, for the audience, I don't know if you had anything else you wanted to highlight before we kind of wrapped up.
For everyone who's trying to get involved in this space, please do. Find something that interests you. Find some way to contribute. Most of the people in this space are incredibly kind, incredibly patient to people who are trying to get it and trying to learn. I went from an enthusiast to a programmer simply because I wanted to chip in. And those communities exist all throughout this entire network. So if there's anything you're interested in, it's at all related to crypto, Web3, DeFi. The first step is really just trying to get your foot in the door, taking the time to learn, and just offering to help. That is a huge thing. I mean, I am still writing strategies at Urine as I'm running for office, as a matter of fact. And that's just because I care about these protocols. I am super interested in the money Legos, so I'm still doing that.
So just take off your campaign hat every day, and you just throw on your strategist hat, and I assume you just don't sleep most of the time.
I work most days.
I don't know how you can be involved in politics and crypto at the same time. It seems like both of them take over 100% of your time.
I mean, I was the kind of person who actually took my sabbatical from Intel to launch my campaign for Congress, so I'm not surprised that this is something that I'm drawn to.
Yeah. Not surprising then.
Yeah. So that's the first step is. Get involved. Get involved in crypto. Get involved in Web3. Second, get involved in politics. This is historically an apolitical space. But what we've seen over the last year is that politics happens to you whether you are engaging with it or not. Everything in some way is political. So right now, our entire community, our entire industry is under very literal threat from overregulation or from outright being banned in certain countries. I mean, China has done it to many memes. India is looking at doing it. The United States has flirted with the idea of banning it on and off again in a way that I think makes a lot of us here kind of feel like it's not going to happen. Like, we just feel like, oh, well, it's another attempt to, we'll survive it. But what I really think the takeaway from that is, it's not that we'll survive it, it's just another attempt. It's that they keep trying. And eventually, one of their attempts will stick. Public perception will be either so strongly in favor of it that it goes through, or like they'll find some legal loophole that finally does, when it gets challenged in court, stands. And at that point, we are in a very serious water. Our entire industry and community will be subjected to shocks. So get involved. Find those people who are actually supporting you and your community, especially in the crypto community, and support them. Ask them how you can help. Donate to their campaigns. Like, this is a huge issue. By all means, support me. I am the first crypto Web3 developer running for office. I'm running a campaign where my main opponent is in the primary election, is actually a state legislator who voted to ban the state of Oregon from interacting with any blockchain. That is now state law in Oregon. Like, this is the actual sort of field that we're playing in right now. People are trying to ban our community, to ban our industry. And if we want to protect it, we really need to step up and support those of us who are fighting to defend it.
So the TLDR seems to be get up, get involved, and speak out.
I think absolutely.
That's probably a great way of summing it up. But Matt, where should people go if they want to learn more about you?
By all means, first step would be my website, www.mattwestforcongress.com. From there, you can find various policy positions. You can also donate either in US dollars or in crypto through BitPay. You can also find me on Twitter, at Matt D. West, and I am on there almost every day reading through posts, reading through replies. I am pretty easy to get a hold of. There's also, for example, at my website, info@mattwestforcongress.com. Send us an email and we will take a look and get back to you. Like, we're pretty out there. We're pretty approachable. So please don't hesitate to reach out.
I can endorse the fact that you are very easy to reach out to. It's very easy just to talk to you on Twitter and schedule this thing. And now, look, I think it's great that everyone's going to know more about you. Thanks for joining.
It's exciting. Thank you so much for having me. This was a blast.
Yeah.
Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to the podcast. If you enjoyed it, please support the show by hitting subscribe on iTunes, writing a review, or sharing this episode on Twitter and LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our next episode out soon.